I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Solutions for making revolution with red songbook and red flag unfurled. 100 years ago, the bard with the union card proved his music was too powerful, too strong. They couldn't stand the sound, they had to take him down lest he organize the working class in song.
You're currently listening to the song Joe Hill by the longtime protest musician David Rovix. Apropos, given that on this edition of Parallax Views, we will be talking about music in the service of change and social justice with Brad Schreiber, author of Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. Available now from Rutgers University Press. In this conversation, we discuss the rich history of socially conscious music, from Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger to artists you may not have even considered political before, such as Leslie Gore and Black Sabbath, among others. With that being said, why don't we get right to the conversation with Brad Schreiber, author of Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change.
100 years ago, the bard with the union card proved his music was too powerful, too strong. They couldn't stand the sound, they had to take him down lest he organize the working class in song. 100 years ago, the bard with the union card proved his music was too powerful, too strong. They couldn't stand the sound, they had to take him down lest he organize the working class in song. Lest he organize the working class in song.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Brad Schreiber, author of the fascinating new book Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change, available now from Rutgers University Press. How are you doing today, Brad?
Oh, thanks a lot for having me on your show, JG.
Well, this book is really fascinating. It's sort of a return to similar territory for you in a lot of ways, because you worked on another music-related book, Becoming Jimi Hendrix. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and your interest in music.
Sure. Well, the short version of my psychotically eclectic resume, JG, would be to say that I've written for all media, TV, film, books, theater, radio. God, I once wrote a sort of phone line called Dial an Insult, in which I wrote rude comments that people would dial up and laugh. And I've done virtually everything, but books are very important to me, and as well political commentary. So Music is Power is an outgrowth of doing two books. As you say, Becoming Jimi Hendrix, 2010, rewritten from the notes of a Hendrix historian named Steve Roby, who was obsessive and amazing in what he collected, but he wasn't a writer. So we went in 50-50 on that, and we discovered a lot of things about Jimmy, and even a political note that no one else had was that Jimmy and Billy Cox, who were both soldiers/musicians at the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, liked to go into Nashville. And at that time in the early 60s, there were sit-in racial demonstrations at lunch counters in Nashville. And Jimmy and Billy Cox purposely sat in a whites-only section of a lunch counter in Nashville and got arrested to protest. And the owner of the club where they performed bailed them out, but he wasn't a very cool guy. He made them pay him back. So, you know, there, that's 2010. Then, like 4 years ago, three and a half years ago, in 2016, I wrote a book that is a little bit more political, Revolution's End, which you noted, and it's a full expose of the origins of the Symbionese Liberation Army, which kidnapped Patty Hearst in 1974. And it's an unbelievably complex story, and I can't go into all of it, but the short version is a former LAPD informant who, long story short, was offered a chance to escape from prison and create a phony left-wing group, the Symbionese Liberation Army, and his white followers never knew that he was a double agent. And Patty Hearst is merely an adjunct to the story of how this operation undermined the Black Panthers and the New Left in Northern California. So that is that's a mouthful there. And put together music and politics, and you come up with Music is Power, which is conveniently timed to the most repressive and dangerous presidential administration in the history of the United States.
Well, it's interesting because at times I feel like there's less socially conscious music today than there should be. Maybe we can get into that later, but one of the things I like about this title, Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change, you don't say protest songs. And I feel like there's a specific reason for that.
Yeah, it's the same reason, JG, that I kind of rankle when people talk about conspiracy theory. If you have facts and documents and you've done your homework, it's not a conspiracy theory. It might be a conspiracy, it might be a cabal, you can call it whatever you like, but it's no longer theory just because it upsets your view of the United States. Similarly, protest music sounds like you're ghettoizing a type of music that only belonged in the 1960s. And Music is Power shows that protest music, if you want to call it that, or socially conscious music, as I prefer, started in the 19-teens and has covered every genre of music right up to today. And there are major artists doing this kind of music. The question of whether this music is going to have a certain impact is a worthy question. Absolutely no doubt that there are scores of people doing it, from Eminem to Barbra Streisand. And the epilogue of Music is Power notes some of the most recent and effective songs in this genre.
And you mentioned that the origins of this socially conscious music can be traced back to at least the 1910s. I believe that you even give, you know, one or two examples even prior to that.
Sure. You know, you can say that amongst the black slaves in the United States, that anything that had a message of strength and will, you know, religiosity, gospel music, in a sense, that is a kind of music that's trying to embolden the human spirit. But for me, the most very specific topics came out of the industrial workers of the world and the 19-teens, and specifically Joe Hill, the Swedish-American labor organizer, who wrote a song called The Preacher and the Slave. And he uses a term that we have popularized now without knowing its origin sometimes, pie in the sky. He referred to that idea and the fact that the poor have to wait for their rewards in heaven. And of course, he's being acerbic and bitter about it. Joe Hill also, well, obviously he was noted by Joan Baez decades later in I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill Last Night. But it's Joe Hill who was killed by a firing squad in Salt Lake City in 1915. He was falsely accused of a murder. And his famous phrase was, don't mourn, organize. And he became, you know, an incredible martyr, and in a way is the first major composer and musician of socially conscious music in America.
Maybe we could dive a little bit more into that first chapter where you cover Joe Hill, Woody Guthrie, and Pete Seeger. You mentioned the IWW, the Wobblies, the International Workers of the World. Maybe you could give a little context for my younger listeners who may be unfamiliar with the IWW and the context of the time that arose in.
Well, people bandy about the term communist today in American politics, which is fairly absurd because there is no substantial communist party in the U.S. But there was, back in the day, what happened with McCarthyism in the 50s, the idea of a communist party and socialism was tightly connected to labor unions, and especially the IWW, because there were so many industries where there were absolutely no protections for laborers. And that's where Joe Hill really established union organizer, as well as, you know, a musician and composer. I'm fascinated by Joe Hill's relationship with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn from the IWW. She was a co-founder later on of the ACLU, and he wrote her an amazing song called The Rebel Girl, about men and women fighting together for labor laws and change. It's the first feminist pop song in a way, and it's 1915.
Wow. That's actually very incredible. I think most people don't think of feminist music coming around till much later on.
That's true, and they also think of women singing feminist songs, not men. I, of course, go on in another chapter to talk about Leslie Gore, who fought to do You Don't Own Me in the mid-60s. You know who her producer was who went to bat for her and insisted that they give her that song to record?
Do tell.
Leslie Gore basically sang songs about heartbreak.
Right, It's My Party.
Yeah, It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To. And she wanted to break out of the mold. Quincy Jones, a new producer, went to the label and said, this is an amazing song and you've got to let her sing something different. And it is an anthem, perhaps one of the earliest female sung anthems. And it's got wonderful edge to it. And it still stands, you know, it's still used today in commercials and films.
Well, I'd like to return to that first chapter, at least a little bit briefly here. Joe Hill is writing during a time of, you know, it's the workers versus the bosses. I don't think people realize at times just how much the labor movement in the U.S. was really important. There was a lot of oppression going on, and you don't have to be a communist or a socialist to understand that. And people like Joe Hill were standing up. They were taking a stand.
Yeah. You know, there's a really great movie that is a perfect example of that struggle between capital and labor in this period. It's by John Sayles, and it's called Matewan, M-A-T-E-W-A-N. Marvelous. And it would give your listeners an idea of what laborers were up against when they didn't want to work 12-hour days, when they didn't want their children to have to work, when they wanted protections against, you know, mines caving in and unsafe working conditions. So that's where Joe Hill came out of, and following on his heels, Woody Guthrie. So those two guys, Hill and Guthrie, influenced so many other people that would come along. You know, we're talking about Bob Dylan, we're talking about Joan Baez, Springsteen, so many other bands that looked to that period of music to inspire them.
Well, Woody Guthrie, I always loved that he had on his guitar, "This Machine Kills Fascists."
Yes. You know, there was a tour, I'm in Los Angeles, and there was a tour of Dylan's ephemera and belongings, and he put, he carved into the back of his early guitar, his acoustic guitar, when he first hit New York, the same phrase, "This machine kills fascists," because he was so impressed by Woody Guthrie, who he visited in his Long Island hospital before Guthrie died.
And then, of course, there's, in this first chapter, there's also Pete Seeger. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about Pete Seeger and his sort of approach to music and his activism.
Yeah, well, Pete Seeger is one of those characters like Baez and Peter, Paul, and Mary and other groups that committed their entire careers to trying to improve the world. Seeger sang with a group called the Weavers, who eventually were blacklisted. We're talking about, you know, after World War II and into the 50s. And, you know, even though he sang beautiful, simple songs like, you know, "If I Had a Hammer," he also sang songs of protest. And because of his association with groups that could be called socialist or communist, there was a blacklist on him being on television. It took 17 years, JG, before, of all people, the Smothers Brothers comedy music duo had him on their show and broke the blacklist.
And, of course, Pete Seeger also stood up against the House of Un-American Activities Committee, which infamously targeted, in the most paranoid of fashions, leftist activists during the Cold War era. I mean, Seeger actually said to this committee, this band of witch hunters, "I have sung for Americans of every political persuasion, and I am proud that I never refused to sing for an audience, no matter what religion or color of their skin or situation of life."
Right, right. He was very brave, and he knew it would impact his career. And unlike other celebrities who cooperated, one thinks of the director Elia Kazan, who didn't have the courage to say, "You don't have a right to ask me these questions under the Constitution," and pay whatever the cost would be to his career. Seeger was very inspiring, and I think that in some ways, you know, he comes right out of that mold of Woody Guthrie. He is very much like Guthrie in another time period. Of course, Guthrie came out of the Depression and the Dust Bowl, and, you know, he would write a song like "Do Re Mi." If you ain't got the Do Re Mi, folks, you ain't got the Do Re Mi, then you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. That song had a residence because 100,000 people a year were being denied the right to enter California from the devastated Dust Bowl states. You know, how does that resonate with our attitude about immigrants worldwide?
Right. There's definitely parallels to today. I think, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same, and we have to keep resisting and keep protesting in the way that these musicians did.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I've often talked about the idea that no musical artist is obligated to spend an entire career writing socially conscious music, you know, like Pete Seeger or Joan Baez. You could write one song that has a huge impact and motivates people, and that's it, and then go back to your love songs. The most influential artists, the ones who have had the most financial and cultural success, are the ones in the best position to talk to their labels and to the corporations who own the labels and say, I've made you plenty of money. Now I'm going to write a song from my heart, and I expect you to back me.
Well, I think this is a way to lead back into Leslie Gore, who I wanted to talk a little bit more about, because I think for younger audiences, she's not as well known, but she did this great bubblegum pop music. We mentioned It's My Party, but she's usually not associated with politically or socially conscious music. But you mentioned the song You Don't Own Me. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about that song and Leslie Gore's background, because I think for a while she probably felt trapped in doing these songs about, you know, crying and, you know, heartbreak and whatnot, and she wanted to do something more than that.
Yeah. As I said earlier, Leslie Gore found this song when she was performing at Grossinger's, which was a resort in the Catskills in New York, and these two Philadelphia songwriters played the song for her while she was sitting around a cabana near a pool. And immediately she realized, this is my one chance to break out of the mold that has been constructed for me as a performer. And women singers had very little control over their careers then. And that's why Quincy Jones standing up for her was so important. I've tied her, in a way, to Janis Ian, who wrote Society's Child. And interestingly, both of those women had their hits that created their careers of social consciousness when they were 16 years old. Leslie Gore went on to come out as a gay woman on a PBS television show decades later, because she couldn't do it when she was younger. There was no toleration of being gay and being an artist in America in the early and mid-60s. So that's another aspect of what she was up against in terms of her society and her music.
And it's interesting as well, because I believe this is all happening around the same time that Betty Friedan comes out with The Feminine Mystique.
Yes, I mentioned that in Music is Power. Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, 1964, same year as You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore. And it's the first book to have success in publishing that suggests to the male hierarchy, women are more than wives, and women are more than someone who stays at home and cooks and cleans. And most people think that the women's movement reached its full flower in the 70s, which is true, but I'm suggesting that in 1964 with Betty Friedan and Leslie Gore, the real beginning of the women's movement in the United States had started at least 6 or 7 years before, and it grew from there.
And I think it's really amazing that Gore was so young when she was doing all of this. And You Don't Own Me, it's an odd song because there's still the occasional line in there where she's saying please in the refrain and whatnot. But she's also asserting her autonomy. And I believe, if I remember correctly, the person the song is speaking to is not named. So I think that's all very interesting. There's a lot of textual analysis that can go into looking at that song.
Yeah. I've noted that, too, in the book. I was fascinated by that, J.G. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. And when I go out with you, don't put me on display. So it sounds like an argument, but the word please is used. So there's a kind of dynamic, because women were not given any power in musical lyrics in the 60s or before. So it was sort of moderating its anger. It was a fascinating, and of course, Quincy Jones' work in making it sound menacing and echoey in the beginning of the song is a fantastic choice. Now, I can't help talking about Janice Ian, not only because she comes right after Leslie in the book, but she faced a lot of problems with society's child. Again, she wrote it when she was 14. It hit the charts when she was 16. And despite that, radio stations banned playing the song about a black boy and a white girl and the problems in their having a relationship in their teens. Everybody talks about the 60s being a revolutionary time, but you know, the sad news is there was still an incredible amount of racism in the United States, you know, in 66, 67, and 68. When people talk about cultural changes here. And I'm sorry to report that Janice Ian was spat upon, that people sent her letters with razor blades taped under the flap of the envelope so that she would cut her fingers. And she underwent incredible pressure after the release of Society's Child.
For members of my audience that may not be as familiar with that song, just based on the title, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit more about it and what it's addressing.
It came out of Janice Ian, who was raised in New Jersey, being on a bus and seeing a black teenage boy and a white teenage girl surreptitiously holding hands. And we're not talking about the Deep South. We're talking about New Jersey. And she thought, it's too bad that they have to hide the fact that they love each other. And so the song reflects the girl's voice telling the black boyfriend, I can't see you anymore. And in a devastating lyrical fashion, at the end of it, she's not saying, I can't see you anymore due to the pressures of her family and society. She has bought into the idea that an interracial relationship can never work. And the lyrics are, I don't want to see you anymore. It's unbelievable songwriting. And, you know, Janice Ian later on wrote about teenage angst in a beautifully powerful way with the song At 17. Obviously a tremendous songwriter.
Well, it's interesting getting into music dealing with racism or issues facing the black community. I was looking over the book again before we got on the phone together to conduct this conversation, and yeah. One of the musicians that really stood out to me that I didn't know a lot about was Curtis Mayfield. Maybe we could talk a little bit about Curtis Mayfield. I'm a big fan of his score to the movie Superfly. It's a 70s blaxploitation movie, but he sort of wanted to put a twist on it with his score. He wanted to sort of challenge certain things he saw in the film.
Yes, blaxploitation movies really grew out of Shaft, and ironically, Curtis Mayfield, who was like James Brown in that he believed in black capitalism and the need to create business opportunities for the black community because obviously white society had failed them. By the way, J.G., Mayfield had four different record labels that he founded. He was a real force of nature. But when it came to Shaft, he almost didn't do the score. And his wife, his widow, inevitably, because sadly Mayfield died before his time, his widow, Altheda, said that his attitude about Superfly was, the world's longest commercial for cocaine in history. And yet, when he did the songs, Freddy's Dead, about the drug dealer, and Superfly, the theme, he wanted to imbue the characters in the songs with dimensionality, even if they were criminals, because he didn't want to simply do an exploitation type of song. He felt that the depiction of blacks in those movies were, you know, people who dealt in drugs and were sexist and were violent and criminal. And he felt that it was reductive, which of course it was. And that is who Curtis Mayfield was. He was a guy who could bring gospel and beautiful R&B into a song and still have a social consciousness in it, without being, you know, too on the nose. Keep On Pushing is an excellent example of a song that almost has a gospel feel and talks about a race of people who need to keep demanding their rights.
And I also note that that chapter with Curtis Mayfield, you also include James Brown. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the inclusion of Brown, because I think most people would maybe raise an eyebrow, because Brown sort of spoke well of, say, Richard Nixon. So I think people may have a knee-jerk reaction to that, and maybe a few of the other inclusions here. Maybe you could talk about the inclusion process you had for artists that maybe people wouldn't consider necessarily radical or, you know, socially conscious in the way that, you know, a 60s anti-war protester would be.
Yeah. Obviously, a song like Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud became an anthem for an entire race of people in USA. James Brown, at that point, was an incredible icon, and it's so sad to consider that his need to connect with everyone and to create a holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. led him to a meeting with Richard Nixon. There's a famous photo of them together, and right after the publication of that photo in newspapers, his fan base started attacking him. That's how polarized the U.S. was over Nixon, the war in Vietnam, and racism. In many ways, that episode is like what we're seeing today, with the polarization between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and a complete unwillingness to make deals with each other, to even communicate with each other. And sadly, that was the demise, the beginning of the demise of James Brown after the Nixon episode. Nixon, of course, did not create an MLK Jr. holiday. It was Stevie Wonder who eventually marshaled support behind that. But Brown, his descent into drugs and alcohol and a career that started bottoming out really came after he tried to get Nixon to accomplish that goal.
It's interesting you mentioned the parallels to today. I think those parallels can even be seen before Trump in a lot of ways with the Bush administration. I remember very well a lot of musicians, a lot of artists were very afraid to speak out. They would be seen as unpatriotic if they spoke out against, say, the Iraq War. And of course, you have an entire chapter devoted to Green Day and also the Dixie Chicks. I know we didn't talk about it before recording this conversation, but I remember very well the Dixie Chicks incident when they spoke out against the Iraq War, and they were pummeled for it.
Yes, absolutely, JG. And it's insane to think that they didn't even write a song protesting the U.S. involvement in Iraq in 2003. They were in London, and Natalie Maine says from the stage, I want you all to know that we're ashamed that the president of the United States is from our home state of Texas. And, of course, the crowd roars in approval because 90% of the United Kingdom was against the invasion of Iraq. Obviously, Tony Blair ignored the will of the people. And that story basically meant that when the Dixie Chicks came back to the U.S., the country music establishment, George W. Bush himself, radio stations, everyone had turned against them, and they were banning their records just like they did with Society's Child and Janis Ian.
And if we could back up just a little bit, there's two more artists I wanted to mention very specifically. Tom Lehrer is the first one I wanted to mention because he's largely forgotten today, unless you listen to Dr. Demento, the great show showcasing novelty songs over the years. Tom Lehrer, though, was a really brilliant satirist. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about him, because I still find him funny to this day. I discovered him when I was in my teens, and he just made me laugh over and over again.
It's so odd, because Tom Lehrer was basically a mathematician, taught at some of the best schools in Boston. And then, just as a sidelight, he started writing funny, topical songs. One of the most interesting ones for me is Pollution, which was the first song artist to talk about the destruction of the ecology. Obviously, you can jump ahead a couple years to Marvin Gaye and Mercy, Mercy Me, the ecology. But Tom Lehrer, in an amusing way, was saying, the breakfast garbage you throw into the bay, they drink for lunch in San Jose. And he took on everything in about 37 songs, from nuclear war to poisoning pigeons in the park. Sometimes it was very dark material, sometimes it was extremely light. But he gave up his songwriting career. He felt like he'd done everything, and went back to teaching mathematics, and now has a very quiet life in the Boston environs. He's in his 90s, and he's not at all interested in doing music anymore. But it's worth finding those songs, which are amazingly well constructed. They make me think of Gilbert and Sullivan's lyrics. They're so brilliantly composed.
I always loved the one track he did, The Vatican Rag, and then he did one about Wernher von Braun.
Right, yeah, and all the V2 rockets. So we actually historically brought, you know, Nazi scientists into America after the war, Operation Paperclip. And that was a funny but biting song about the relative morals of the United States after World War II, and dealing with not only Wernher von Braun, who designed the V2 rockets, but many other Nazi scientists. It's kind of chilling to think that America was willing to do that after the horrors of the Second World War.
And the other artist I wanted to mention before we sort of tackle the issue of socially conscious music more broadly is Black Sabbath, who I think most people would not think of as being political. But if you look at songs like Paranoid and War Pigs, there's definitely a little bit of a social context there.
Well, it's amusing in a strange way, because Black Sabbath stumbled into writing the first socially conscious metal song, War Pigs. They were playing in Switzerland at a club, and there were a lot of U.S. soldiers who were telling the members of the band about the horrors of the Vietnam War. So they wrote a song called Walpurgis, which was supposed to be about paganism, and they thought it was dark and creepy and menacing and cool. And the label said, no, you are not doing a song called Walpurgis, and you're not going to sing about paganism and rituals. So they decided, almost in a comical way, Walpurgis, that sounds like War Pigs. Yeah, let's call the song War Pigs. And so they equated, in a very brilliant way, an idea that had never been done in music, which is to equate Satanism, which is a theme in heavy metal music, with the military and with generals and the need for war regularly in society. And to his credit, Ozzy Osbourne wrote other songs both in Black Sabbath and outside of it that addressed war and other topical issues. I make the point, JG, that in music, in power, music is power. I think that punk and heavy metal and hip hop have a natural aggression to the sound of their music, and is perfectly suited to more of these kinds of songs. And there's been a failure in those genres of music to really write songs that are powerful and about what's happening in the world.
I would definitely agree with you on that, especially when it comes to metal. I think a lot of times different metal genres can come off as very juvenile, at times extremely reactionary, but there are those diamonds in the rough that do tackle topics like war and corruption in ways that I think are meaningful. Bands like Ministry. I think the metal genre has a lot more that could be utilized in a socially conscious way.
Sure. And, you know, in Music is Power, of course, you know, for hip-hop, you know, which was originally called rap music, you know, I talk about the NWAs and the Grandmaster Flashes of the world, and I talk about Gil Scott-Heron, who with his lyrics was way ahead of the curve on topical songs with a variety of music, sometimes jazz music or just percussion under his fantastic poetry. And in terms of punk, we have the Dead Kennedys in San Francisco and their commitment to politically oriented music, and the Sex Pistols, which I feel were more performance art than they were music. And that was a fun chapter to write because so many outrageous things happened to the Sex Pistols in their brief careers. And the other thing about them, JG, was they were led by a guy named Malcolm McLaren, who was a clothing store owner and had absolutely no social conscience, knew nothing about music, and delighted in the Sex Pistols getting arrested and upsetting British society because it simply sold more records.
I think McLaren would go on to play a role in New Wave as well, sort of wanting to sell his fashion lines out of that. He was very much, you know, in it for the money.
Yeah, and I was fascinated by the fact that when God Save the Queen came out and the Sex Pistols equated the Queen with fascism, it infuriated not only conservative people, it infuriated young people whose parents had lived through the Blitz, had lived through the devastation of the bombing of London, and here's this very unmusical group calling the Queen a fascist. And believe it or not, members of Parliament debated the idea of hanging the Sex Pistols.
Wow.
From Traitor's Gate at the Tower of London. Obviously, that vote didn't go through, but that's how furious people were with the Sex Pistols. And it became kind of an identifier more than it became a real musical movement. People on the streets of London who dressed like punks were being beaten just for the way they appeared. It was nihilistic, but at the same time, it also reflected 30% unemployment, a complete devastation in the energy sector in the UK, where Londoners were dining by candlelight because there wasn't enough power, electrical power, in their homes.
Yeah, this is under the Thatcher years, which if you talk to people from Britain, especially from the working class, they remember the Thatcher years not very fondly. They are not very happy with those years.
Sure. And so Music is Power on a regular basis is an attempt to connect what's happening in society and the difficulties in society generating more of this kind of music. We're seeing more of this music now because of Trump and a nationwide authoritarian shift in governments of countries. And, of course, people are now standing up more. You see in the Oscars a couple of nights ago, Joaquin Phoenix delivering a speech that didn't thank a single person on the film Joker, but talked about what's going on in the world. You'll see more and more of this as there's more and more repression.
It reminded me of what Marlon Brando did at the Academy Awards as well, that Joaquin Phoenix moment where he, you know, Marlon Brando basically gave his time over to allow a representative of the Native American Indian movement to speak. So, again, I think we see a line throughout the history of popular music and popular film and just popular culture in general where these things can be used, these mediums can be used to relay a message. And it's interesting because I noticed there's some artists that try to push back on this. Alice Cooper famously has said, oh, music shouldn't be about politics. And of course, Ted Nugent complains about left-wing musicians. I feel that there's something so just, I feel like there's something insincere about that. I feel like being apolitical in your music is almost political in itself, because you're saying I'm okay with the status quo.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I would go back to my earlier comment that I am not saying that every single musical artist has, you know, an ultimatum. They must do this. But doing one single song can have a huge effect. And unlike an actor, even a very big movie star who's dependent upon the director and the script and can only express him or herself, you know, in interviews, the musical artists are doing songs, plural. So if you have a number of songs on a certain release, you can certainly take one song, it seems to me, and talk about what you feel is important in society. But again, it's that idea of commerce. Can you prove that this kind of music does make money? That's what happened with psychedelic and socially conscious soul and R&B. That's why, you know, you had Ball of Confusion by the Temptations. Norman Whitfield, the producer at Motown, had zero political consciousness, but he was seeing that other people, Marvin Gaye and all the other artists who were doing this kind of music, were having an impact. And he saw it as an idea to make money for a Motown act who normally sang love songs. And it worked. So that's what that's probably what the corporations and the labels would always say is, will this make money? And we have to say, yes, it can make money. It has historically. It's also about what's going on in society, the quality of the song, the quality of, you know, the lyrics. But of course, it will always make money if it works musically as well as topically.
Well, also, I've always found this idea that popular music should stray away from being too political. It's just bizarre to me because, I mean, it's in the title, popular music, popular song. Yeah. These are songs that speak to the masses, and the masses, the issues that they're facing, the struggles they are facing, which are usually extremely social.
Right, right. Well, there are love songs, and there always will be love songs, and that's fine, but there are so many different reasons to write a song. Nobody criticized Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel when in their first couple of albums, they did extremely social conscious songs. And nobody faults Paul Simon for the variety of songs that he has done. You know, for God's sakes, he's worked with Ladysmith Black Mambazo. You know, he is entitled as an artist to do whatever he likes. But much like Dylan, in the beginning of his career, he felt compelled to write these kinds of songs, and he did it brilliantly.
And if you have a few more minutes, I wanted to mention, there's one chapter that really sticks out because most of the chapters deal with two or three artists. But you have one chapter that's devoted solely to Frank Zappa. And I love the title of it. It's basically Frank Zappa versus everyone, Frank Zappa versus the world. Yeah. Let's talk about Frank Zappa because he's a very odd figure and his politics aren't exactly clear. I always like that when he went on Crossfire, John Lofton said, "You're an anarchist." And Frank Zappa said, "No, I'm a conservative. And you might not like that, but I am." And, you know, Frank Zappa would probably say to anyone that would get mad at him for that, "Well, you can kiss my ass." But he also was he wasn't a conservative in the normal sense of the word either. And one wonders if he was joking a little bit with that.
I think that, well, this chapter is very close to my heart, JG, because I knew Frank and worked with him for 6 months trying to create a late-night show called Night School. I was going to be his head writer. So in that process, I got to know him very well, and it was during the whole Parents Music Resource Center battle, where Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife, and other Washington, D.C. ladies were trying to censor rock and roll lyrics and album covers. And it was Frank Zappa who said, wait a second, it's not just this. They're trying to pass a law that would put a tax on blank tape and a tax on recording devices, because the music industry's watchdog group, the RIAA, wanted people to stop taping music and giving it to their friends. And Zappa spent the equivalent in 2020 dollars of about $180,000 out of his own pocket to make people aware that this bill in Congress should be defeated, and it was. In terms of how he identified himself, JG, I make the point in Music is Power that he was kind of a libertarian Democrat. You know, he had an open mind, but at the same time, he wanted the government to take its hand out of his wallet. And, you know, he was amazing. He was a singer, musician, songwriter, arranger, producer, produced video, distributed his own work. He was very much a libertarian. He said, I'll do it myself. And as for drugs, he didn't do drugs. He'd tell the guys in his band, when you show up for a rehearsal, if you can't play the charts, you're out of the band. So you may want to think twice about coming to the studio stone, and you certainly don't do it around me. So, you know, I appreciate the fact that the music that he created was incredibly funny at times, incredibly bitter at times, incredibly scatological at times. And by the end of his career, by the way, he's creating classical music and electronic music. There's never been anybody quite like him. And I'm the slime, according to Barry Miles, who wrote the biography on Paul McCartney and others, said, I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa is perhaps the best social conscience song of all time, because it talks about the government and the media shaping your own behavior. And at the very bottom of it all, I'll finish with this on Frank, at the very bottom of it all, Zappa is about people making up their own minds and not being fashionable and not being hip, but doing what they believe in without anybody influencing their decision.
Well, I'll add one more thing about Zappa. I don't really identify with his sort of libertarian streak as much, but I probably identify with him overall more than I do a lot of other artists, because especially when it comes to his views on the 60s, he sort of had this mentality of, no, it wasn't necessarily the greatest time. And also, I think he's right when he points out psychedelics alone, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out. That's not enough. That's not going to change the world. You actually have to do things. You have to get active. And I know he sort of pushes back greatly on the everyone has to look inward and, you know, peace and love will just save us alone. But I think in a lot of ways he's right about that. I think it takes a lot more than just looking inward to bring about political change. And I really, really appreciate that about Zappa.
It's a great point, JG. And I would add to that that there is, strangely enough, a connection between what you just said about not taking drugs and dropping out of the political process in the world and Jimi Hendrix's Are You Experienced? Another topic I'm very close to, because I wrote Becoming Jimi Hendrix, as we discussed at the top of the interview. And I've met a lot of people who knew Jimi. And Are You Experienced is the only song of the psychedelic era that suggests you can take drugs for a higher consciousness, but you can get there without them. And in order to improve the quality of the world, you need to attain a higher consciousness. You know, who else was saying, not necessarily stoned, but beautiful? Jimmy was about the spirit and about a higher level of consciousness that may or may not have been connected to drugs.
And before we close out, I have to mention at least briefly, you have a chapter on Pink Floyd. And it's interesting because I know Roger Waters is touring again, and I see all these pundits and, you know, commentators and trolls online saying, oh, Roger Waters and his politics, and he always has to, you know, put politics into it all. But that's actually what I like about Roger Waters. And I think that Pink Floyd was actually a much more socially conscious band than people realize, especially after that first album when Syd Barrett, the singer, sort of has this mental breakdown. I think it really affected that band and made them think about things a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the most fascinating questions in the history of rock and roll. Did Syd Barrett, who, by the way, is the founder of Pink Floyd, go crazy because he took too much LSD, or did he basically have a mental disorder that was exacerbated by LSD? And what I'm saying is, here's all the research, and you, the reader, decide, but let's look at the incredible irony of Syd Barrett going crazy, and that is they're no longer writing songs like Arnold Lane about a guy stealing women's underwear off of a clothesline. They're going to write music about madness and alienation and the power of the state and war, and they're going to become one of the greatest bands in the history of recorded music to explore those themes. And of course, while Roger Waters and The Wall, definitely political in nature, that's not all they did. You know, tell me where the politics are in Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun. I'm very, very fond of the very psychedelic era of Pink Floyd and their albums like Uma Guma. But at the same time, Roger Waters lost his father in World War II and lost his grandfather in World War I. So one shouldn't be surprised that when you go see The Wall in concert, that you'll see the images of dead soldiers, because war and its horrors and futility are part of Roger Waters' own history.
I think, too, that The Wall, the movie, is an absolutely incredible statement politically and socially. I mean, just the imagery. It's about alienation. It's also just about how society can put people through a literal meat grinder. And there's this imagery of an ominous fascism that I think Pink Floyd captured in The Wall better than almost any other artist.
Yeah, I believe Ronald Searle was the animator and visual artist, and the idea of hammers that are marching along and imagery that is reminiscent of swastikas, very powerful. And it's yet another way that Pink Floyd is responding that they never would have responded, you know, had they not lost the leader of their band to madness. There are so many, you know, Us and Them, you know, there are so many fantastic songs. Wish You Were Here. There are so many songs that connect to the loss of someone mentally. And of course, the music itself is incredibly powerful. Everybody talks about Dark Side of the Moon being on the music charts for over 2 years, which is almost unheard of in the recording industry. So it's a combination of their creation of music and these really powerful themes that young people can always connect to, because being young and trying to become an adult and be self-sufficient is filled with all of these challenges, and a lot of it is about madness, alienation, and societal control. And that's in a way why Pink Floyd is timeless.
Well, I know we have to wrap up here. There's so many other artists we could have covered. We didn't even get to Peter Gabriel is the only Genesis I need. I'm not as into the Phil Collins stuff. There's so many great artists, though, you'd cover. I guess in closing, I want to pop the big question here, because I think a lot of people look at music or film or any type of popular culture and will say, it can't change the world. And I think that's true. On its own, I don't think art necessarily changes the world, but I think it can be a motivator for people. I think it can keep people alive and wanting to continue the struggle. So I want to get your opinion, though, on this issue. Why is music power, in your view?
Well, with all due respect, and I've really enjoyed this chat with you, JG, I have to disagree. It doesn't happen often, but music does change the world. Peter Gabriel's Biko led college students with a knowledge of the murder of Stephen Biko in South Africa to go to their universities and demand divestment of investments in South Africa. And within a decade, more than $1 billion, with a B, $1 billion of U.S. money, was pulled out of South Africa. And, you know, Eve of Destruction, Phil Sloan, he talks about you're old enough to kill but not for voting. That song generated the discussion of the 26th Amendment, which Nixon signed, that gave 18-year-olds the vote for the first time. So you can't say that music can't occasionally make a difference in the world. If nothing else, it makes us aware of things that we like to ignore in the world, and that's the process of making the world better at whatever speed it happens.
No, you know what? I would agree with that. I think if the music can make people stand to take an action, then yes, music has changed the world. So I have to amend my prior statement, I guess.
Yes, that's an amendment to your own constitution.
Well, in closing, is there anything else you would like to say to my listeners? I always like to end on a positive note. Any positive vibes you can give out that relate back to Music is Power or your work in general?
Well, I appreciate that. And I think the positive message is in the epilogue where I talk about artists today, like I said, from Eminem to Barbra Streisand to A Tribe Called Quest. And there are other groups doing this kind of music. You have to remember that the marketplace is more fractionated than ever. So there are lots of different charts. There are lots of different ways of disseminating music. That's positive for artists who don't have a lot of money or don't have a lot of backing, aren't with a major label, but they can still do the work to get their music out there. And depending on how long and how hard they work, they can find their audiences. So I disagree with the premise that socially conscious music has disappeared. It's a more of a complex marketplace, but the people are out there. And as I say, the more difficult times become, the more artists react to the world around them. And that's as it should be.
And, you know, I just thought of it. I'm not trying to keep you too long over time.
No, that's fine.
But I just thought of it because I didn't mention it before, but there are a lot of artists in this book that sacrificed for the ability to relay the message they felt was important to convey to the masses. Maybe you could just briefly give some examples of artists who did sacrifice and, you know, suffered a little bit for it. Although I would say the positive thing is they're the ones that we remember today.
Yeah, I'm particularly fond of Phil Sloan, P.F. Sloan, who I knew in the last couple of years of his life here in L.A. And Eve of Destruction was condemned by people in rock and roll like Paul Simon and John Lennon and Paul McCartney because it was too on the nose. But it went to number one, and it affected people around the world. And despite the hardships that he endured, that song is considered a masterpiece now. Sometimes you have to wait and see the effects. It's like back to the Dixie Chicks and then to Green Day. The Dixie Chicks are criticized just for saying something about the Iraq War. 2 years later, Green Day does American Idiot and in its storyline condemns George W. Bush, and people are agreeing with them. So sometimes your music will find its way, and sometimes political protest also finds its way over the passage of time. You have to take a perspective of what you're trying to do and when it will be accepted, and not be defeated. But to understand, I think Gil Scott-Heron said it best. You know, he talked about revolution. The idea of revolution isn't about you immediately changing the world. You are part of a continuum. There's a great quote in there that people will find in Music is Power, where he suggests that there are people who have responsibilities along the way, through time, and all those people are part of the inevitable change and the inevitable revolution. So you have to keep that in mind so you don't despair.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. Brad Schreiber, author of Music is Power, I'd like to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If you want to let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work, please do so.
Oh, thank you, JG. Yeah, my website is brashcyber.com. Sounds like you're saying Brad Schreiber, but you're drunk off your ass. Brashcyber.com. I'm on, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all that other stuff. And I post wonderful interviews like this one, JG, on Facebook so that people can, you know, sometimes hear what I'm talking about. The next book probably is going to be historical. I'm going to probably write a book about the hidden story of the Manson murders and how it involved mob figures, celebrities, and a completely corrupt DA's office in order to give the world the impression that hippies were committing random murders.
Well, I look forward to reading that, and I hope folks will check out Music is Power.
Thank you again. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brad Schreiber, author of Music is Power: Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. Available now from Rutgers University Press. Check it out, folks. So what do you think? Can music change the world? Let me know by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, consider supporting me on Patreon, where you can hear archived editions of past Parallax Views programs, as well as our current events program, The Week That Was. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.